the first week I was in California, I dusted up my suit and I went to the SpaceX building and tried to walk in. The security guard stopped me and said, you couldn't go any further than that. I stood outside, kept asking people and people who worked at SpaceX. I was like, I need Elon's number. I need to talk to him. And I finally was able to get the vice president of propulsion to talk to me only after about 2 weeks of my stay in the U.S.
This is The New School with your host, Christine Hong. Welcome to a new kind of school, where we talk about career paths you don't normally get to hear about in the classroom. Every episode, I talk to someone with an interesting life path and learn about how they got to where they are today. Hey guys, I'm your host, Christine Hong, and welcome to the first episode of our third season. We are so excited to be back, and I cannot wait for you to hear the incredible guests we have for you today. This guy is seriously impressive. I feel like when we were growing up, so many boys said, when I grew up, I want to work in space travel, but it just ended up being a pipe dream for most of them. That is not the case for our guest today. Ofniel Mobalo grew up in rural Nigeria, where he had access to literally 500 megabytes of internet a week at a local internet cafe. Yet somehow he went from reading up on rockets on a old Nokia phone in Nigeria to launching his own aerospace company at age 28 in Los Angeles that aims to revolutionize space travel. In this episode, I speak to Ofniel about how he made his first aerospace patent at age 16, but then couldn't afford to publish it, how he was able to use the press in Nigeria to get the U.S. embassy to notice him and get him a visa to the USA to achieve his aerospace dreams, and how he got millions in funding for his current aerospace company, Advanced Rockets Corporation. Okay, thank you so much for being on our show. It's really nice to meet you. I was kind of curious, like, kind of what your childhood was like. Like, what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on your show. I'm pretty excited about this and getting to talk to your audience and yourself about, you know, some of my experiences growing up in Nigeria. So my childhood was pretty interesting, I'd say. You know, just like almost every other kid, I had all of these goals and dreams and what I thought the world was like. And I always wanted to travel. I was always fascinated by everything that I saw on TV, the occasional time that I did get to see a TV. And that shaped my growing years from when I was 3. And so it's just a progression of all the different things that, which is normal for developing children. The uniqueness in that is I grew up in a mix of sort of a slum mixed with modern city life. And so you were living in the slum, but the city was just nearby. And so that sort of interaction of seeing what a good life could be like, looks like, feels like, and then returning home to not having much and knowing that that was your reality and also feeling trapped by that. I think that fight, that balance was what created the thought processes that led up to me doing everything that it is I'm doing today. And so I'm pretty grateful for that because it opened up a whole lot of things, made a whole lot of things apparent to me, as much as I didn't enjoy a whole lot of it.
Yeah. Wait, so how did you even start an interest in aerospace while you were growing up?
So as a part of that, the beautiful side of not having everything you ever wanted, most parts of the slum didn't have electricity. And depending on how far away from the city you were, we didn't have a lot of light pollution. And so we actually lived at least an hour away from the slum that I grew up in, at least an hour away from the city. And so I had the full night sky view. I could see the stars. I could see details that since I moved to Los Angeles, quite frankly, I haven't seen, except when I go spend a few weeks in the woods or whatever. But it's that fascination with what is out there, I think from a very early age, and how big are stars. I remember asking my dad questions like, can I bring a star back down to Earth? And would it be possible for me to go to space? Is there like a door that you have to open when you go really high? I never got to fly in an airplane. So I really didn't have a good concept for what that felt like. And so my fascination with space and space exploration and all of that stuff started at a very early age of just looking up and wanting to go out there. I think one of the things that I, from a very early age, had always wanted to do for some reason is when I turned 80 or 90, I wanted to get on a spaceship, say, and then just fly out into space and go as far out as I can and be the human who's traveled the farthest away from Earth and probably die in that ship, but just be remembered for that. And so as a child, imagine thinking, having a thought process as such. And so I've always wanted to explore. I loved and cherished family, but for me, exploration and doing that thing, the next big thing, has always been my primary driving force, maybe, I would say.
That's so funny that you were ready to be a martyr as a child. You're like, if I die in space at age 30, it's fine. So, I mean, a lot of people, I think their kind of dream job when they're a kid is like, it's to be astronaut, honestly. I feel like especially a lot of boys are that way, but they end up being like, okay, well, gotta do something realistic, or I don't even know how to become an astronaut, even like if you're growing up in a big city in America. So how did you start making this dream a reality in rural Nigeria?
So yeah, we all want to be astronauts. It's the thing that when you go to Korea Day and you ask a little bunch of little kids, I want to be a doctor, I want to be this, and I want to be an astronaut, a spaceman, and go to space. And honestly, there was, for a very long period of time, there was a little bit of that. It wasn't, obviously, as a developing mind, it wasn't always clear to me that I was going to do that. I didn't have the tools, and most kids do not, even if they grew up in the United States, to make a full determination. I knew I loved the sciences from a very early age, but I wasn't well equipped to make a determination as to whether I was going to eventually do that. Also because my parents had a big say in what I got to do or not do. As far as transitioning from this becoming a dream or a fascination into something that I started taking seriously, I don't think there was a clear-cut point where that happened. I think it was a gradual progression, rather, a gradual set of events that led me to start believing more and more that this was what I was going to end up doing. I think key amongst that would be getting the kinds of recommendations and praise that I got from my teachers, who would ask questions in class and direct that question to the entire school. And I would be the only one at school who knew the answer. I was doing recess at school. I would have 30 or 40 kids, I remember like yesterday, around me, listening to me talk about space and read textbooks from five classes ahead of myself and all of that stuff. I was always that kid. I did things that none of the other kids thought was possible. So a little bit of a celebrity in those early years. So as to your point, to the question, I think reading about space and watching documentaries and developing an undying passion at some point where I said to myself, this is absolutely everything that I'm going to do, and I'm going to dedicate all of my life to it. Even though I knew that Nigeria had no space program, no African country did. Even though I knew that I probably will be stuck in Nigeria, I think that was the most difficult part for me. I didn't have a relative who lived in the United States. I didn't have any path to leave the country. And so I was doing this thing that made everyone in my family and in the community think I was a little bit crazy. People would make the hand sign, oh, here comes the crazy guy, when I walked by. I was legit into it. I didn't care for anything else. I didn't care for going to dances or parties or girls or whatever it is that normal young teenagers or, you know, little kids growing up did.
Yeah, I think that's always a weird age when you're a kid, when you first realize you know more than your teacher. So I understand that you were able to read aerospace books and like watch documentaries and read up, but how did you really start your career in aerospace? What's the first thing you can really remember that like helped you get to where you are today?
So my career took a very weird part. I think when I was in senior high school, so high school in Nigeria would be 3 years junior and 3 years senior. My first year of senior high school, we were starting to do advanced physics and chemistry and some of the other subjects. And at the very end of one of the textbooks, at the very end, I think one of the final last pages, there was this talk about space and space exploration. Now, prior to this, obviously, I've had my enthusiasm for space. And so that's stayed alive. But a whole lot of things happened in between junior high school and then my first year in senior high school. And I remember seeing that the space shuttle at the very back page of that textbook. That for me was very striking because everything else that was being thought was taught as this is what is most likely going to happen to you. And this is where your life is going. You're going to end up doing all of these things. You're going to end up being a clinician, which is a beautiful job. And if you get to do that, that's amazing. But you get to do all of these other things. It's more realistic. And then this space stuff is at the very back, very end of the textbook, because It's just don't even think about it.
Yeah. Don't bother.
Yeah, that was my thought as to why they put it there. And it upset me that it was there. And then I think I made a conscious decision. I was like, okay, I'm going to prove you guys wrong. And you guys was not actually anybody. It was just the whole idea, the whole thought process. My parents would say to me, and I hope they forgive me if they hear this, but I love them. I love them. And yeah, anyways, not just my parents, the general thinking in Africa would be, well, you can't do that because that's white folk stuff, right? You can't be an engineer. You can't work on phones. So the people who were supposed to be your support structure are saying to you, not that, well, it's going to be difficult or you're going to have to fight hard. They're saying to you, you can't do that. You're not white. And so I made a determination that I'm going to prove everyone in that society that believes and thinks that way wrong. There are very few aerospace engineers that are people of color. And so it's to see if the world is built in a way where people of color play basketball and make music and are comedians and everyone else does, you know, engineering and all that stuff. And I think a big part of my journey has been to try to tell the other young black man somewhere, a kid somewhere growing up that wants to do the same thing, but doesn't see enough heroes or people who have done the same thing and taken a difficult path, maybe that they can. It's within their capacity and capability to do it, and they can become whatever it is they want to do. So a big part of my story and determination to do all of this has been wanting to change that way of thinking. It's been amazing. And every time, you know, you achieve a couple of things or two, you feel like you're a step closer to doing that. But a whole lot of things happened in between junior high school and senior high school. I filed for my first WIPO PCT patent. I wrote that patent myself. The legal and the engineering work, filed it, got a response. I got a call from Switzerland, from Geneva, Switzerland. And for a kid growing up in Nigeria who heard about Switzerland on the TV and read about it, it felt like heaven for me. It was like, wow, there's this person from Switzerland calling me. I must be special. And so those little things spurred me and made me want to do more.
Right. Were you able to file that first patent? I remember reading that you had issues with it or something.
Yeah, I filed for that first patent, but it was a provisional patent. And what that means is the lifetime of that patent is about a year. You have to follow up with a secondary application. I had all my money saved up to file for that initial one and had to sell the laptop that I used to file that application. And my dad would have killed me if he found out, if he knew that I did that. So I didn't tell my dad. I just told him, yeah, I gave the laptop to a friend or something. I don't remember right now, but I came up with something and I was able to make up that money and file the patent for that application. Because I couldn't continue to prosecute the patent application, it was dropped and I felt really sad. But looking back now, I was like, yeah, that's a pretty good experience. I learned a lot and, you know, have other things that I've been able to achieve since then. So
I was wondering, I guess I feel like, are these kind of resources even available online, like learning aerospace properly and like modern technology? I imagine books are like kind of outdated or not that detailed.
So yeah, you're absolutely right. The resources for learning some of these things, aerospace engineering is tied to national security. And so the data information you can get in the public domain is very restrictive. And if you live in the US, you have access to even more information. I can go to Lockheed Martin's website. It would appear differently in the US than it would, say, in Nigeria. So I didn't have access to a whole lot of information. I had something, though, that I would suggest was better. And that's human ingenuity. And obviously, this is something we all have as humans. And so when we have a problem, we try to figure out ways around it. And so I started learning from a very early age how to circumvent local restrictions on the kind of information you could access. I could tunnel into US servers and I could extract data and, you know, do all of that stuff. I do have some programming skills and that's as much as I want to say about that. But
oh my God, that's genius.
Yes, I was able to do some pretty cool stuff. And yeah, that's how I got access to some of the data, some of the information and lectures and all of that stuff that I otherwise would have not. And this is actually in the later age, the later stages. In the very early stages, without a computer or any of that, I had to rely on my mobile phone and not a smartphone. Most people will not remember, but it's like the phones that succeeded the Nokia 3310. But it has a screen that is maybe 2 inches.
You can play Snake and that's about it.
That's correct.
T9 keypad, right?
Yep. Yeah. I think it was the E-series. And I remember downloading websites and lectures from the internet every time I had, 10 megabytes of data, literally for maybe a week. That's all you get.
Wait, what? Like, you would have to go to like a internet cafe and just download information onto a drive?
So it was a couple of things. So first of all, every time I reloaded, and some of this concept might sound strange to some of your audience members. So in Nigeria, you go to a kiosk and you ask a lady or a guy that you wanted airtime. And they'd give you a thing, scratchable card. You scratch the card, you input a specific number of digits, and that basically reloaded your phone and gave you maybe 30 minutes or an hour of call time. But every time you reload that, you also get 10 megabytes of free data. And that 10 megabytes was my window to the world. And I only got to do that maybe once every week. And every time I would get that, I'd go to Wikipedia, I'd go to a whole bunch of other websites, and I would download articles and save them on my phone. And I would lay in bed or sit on my table and just scroll through on that tiny little phone. And that's how I was able to teach myself a whole lot of what I still use today, spare aerospace engineering.
Wow. Wait, so were you just like pre-planning what you're going to Google search before you got there?
Yes, you had to. So every time I read, I had specific topics that I wasn't well informed on. And so I had to take notes very meticulously. And so the next time that the next 10 megabytes would come around, I would grade them from the degree of importance. These are the things that I think are most important. I would download articles on those, made sure that I was able to get that. And then the things that are not as important, if I have any more data left. By the way, 10 megabytes is only enough for you to browse through maybe 4 or 5 Wikipedia pages, and that's it.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So what was your first patent? Like, how did you invent something for the first time?
The first patent was a propulsion system. One of the things that I noticed at the very initial stages of my, if you like, foray into space exploration and jet propulsion was that jet engines had a quality where most jet engines that had the high thrust potential, they can generate a lot of force at an instantaneous time, at a given period of time, were usually not as efficient as engines that could go really fast. So my research then centered around being able to find a jet engine that could go, can travel at really high speed, but had the same efficiency as the jet engines that didn't really go fast, but were highly efficient. And so the initial patent that I filed for was my way of trying to solve that problem. Now, of course, when I look back at that patent application, it's really cute. I laugh at, some of the mistakes that I made and some of the things that I did. I'm like, I think when a writer looks back at some of the things they wrote like 20 years ago. But that was a very instructive part of my learning process because it taught me how to look at concepts and ideas. And by the way, when I moved to the United States, if someone were to say to me, what is the most important aspect of developing technology? I would say to them, they might expect smart or any of that stuff. And I would say to them, really, it's just determination and guts and wanting to do something. And I think that to me was the most critical aspect of doing this because what I had with me, the development that I had for the engine that I had, a propulsion system that I had when I moved to the States, when I even look at that and how much I've learned and how much it has developed since then, it's also quite laughable or, wow, look at how much we've done. Maybe not laughable, but just, you nod your head at, appreciate how much you've learned.
Yeah, for sure. So I understand like figuring out the patent and what you're supposed to do, but it sounds very expensive to make a space rocket and get those parts. So I was wondering, how are you able to even make your first company, a space company? Like, what did you do?
I knew going to space was expensive. In fact, I think there's probably a secondary reason why I started paying as much attention to it as I did. I wanted to launch a rocket in Nigeria. And I found that I couldn't afford to pay for any of the parts. And I needed government approval and all of that other stuff, but maybe less so in Nigeria than maybe in the United States. But I found out very, very early on. And my reaction to that was to try to develop a very cost-effective, very cheap rocket system. And that's been the goal from day one. Rockets are very expensive. And so even when I talk about, low-cost launch systems, it's all relative. In the early ages, it was family, friends, well-wishers, all of that stuff. But as we develop, as the effort has developed and where we are right now, it's, big venture firms and big organizations and wealthy angel investors and all of that stuff. And that's how we're able to fund. And then the government, obviously, that's how we've been able to fund this. So different stages, it's been different people and all of that has allowed for us to pay for what we're doing.
So what was your first company? Like, did you start that in Nigeria? Because I knew you founded a company before it.
ARK is the most recent, and ARK is going to be around for a while. We're doing a lot of exciting and fascinating things. But my first company when I moved to the US was Othniel Dynamics. It had my name in it. So I had a little bit of an ego back in the day. I probably still do. And when I was in Nigeria, I worked with a few organizations. I didn't really have a company going at the time. I just, collaborated with some engineers and folks who thought like me. There were very few of them, but if you looked hard enough, you could find them. And yeah.
Awesome. Were you able to live off this? Or actually, I don't even imagine how you make money on that at all in the early stages. So did you have to have a day job during this experience?
Yeah. One of the things I did in Nigeria was I learned how to do some really fancy computer stuff. In other words, I could fix computers hardware, and I could fix computers software. And so a lot of people within the community would come to me for things that I'd be like, oh my gosh, why can't you guys just figure this out? You're really going to pay me to do this? That was my thought process at the time. I just found it a bit funny. But yeah, so I was the guy and everyone came to me when they had problems. And that was how I was able to pay for my day-to-day, living and all of that stuff. And the reason I liked that was it allowed for me to do this, in those moments, because I didn't have a boss or a fixed schedule. And I interacted with tech, which I loved doing. And so that's how I paid for this. I moved to the US, obviously, things change. When I moved to the US, to put it simply, I didn't know how to get on a bus, right? I didn't know anybody. I had to learn everything and figure everything out myself. We could talk about this later, but I was homeless for a little while, slept on the street. And I think I had about $500 or $600. Went to the first Best Buy, got a computer, because I told myself, as long as I have the tools that I need to work, I'm going to survive. And so I ended up with maybe $100. So, but yeah, it's been a fascinating journey. I think I lost myself there for a little bit, but hopefully I answered that question.
Well, so you're doing these day jobs during day and basically aerospace at night. How did you make it to America? Do you just show them your patents and you're like, hey, like, I'm legit? And then
let me in.
Basically.
No, I don't want to get into that whole debate, talk or wit or whatever, but moving to the United States, the process is quite rigorous, right? And so I had a few TV interviews, appearances in Nigeria, and I think a few newspaper articles on myself. I went to a TV station. I woke up one day. This is kind of who I was. And I think to a large extent, I still am. But obviously, as you get older, you sort of modulate that. I woke up one morning and I said, I'm going to go to a TV station. I'm doing all this cool stuff. And I want them to know. I want the world to know. And I didn't know what a TV station is. I just asked around and they said, yeah, go to XYZ Hill. I took literally all the money that I had in the world, got in a taxi cab, went to the first location. And they told me, oh, the TV station is not here. I got on another taxi. I said, okay, am I going to turn around now and go home? I still have enough money to take me home. But if I go to the next location, which I'm not even sure anyone would be there, I might feel like I failed the first time. So I decided to get in the taxi cab. And you know what I did? Of course, I went to the next location to see if there was a TV station there. I arrived and yes, there was a TV station there. I just walked in. There was all the security and everything that you'd expect. I said, I want to be on TV. I've been doing all this stuff. Are you guys going to give me airtime? They're like, yeah, it's really expensive though. I was like, no, when you hear me, you're not going to charge me anything. So they said, okay, take XYZ's number, go home. We'll call you next year. This was in December. And in January, I get a call. They told me they were sending people to my house to interview me. do all of that stuff. They sent a crew. My neighbors were like, oh, wow, what did he do now? What's happening? And all of that stuff, right? In the ghetto, in the middle of nowhere. I did that interview. And then they invited me in studio for an actual interview. I actually got paid after I did that interview.
I didn't realize they pay you for interviews.
They don't, but I did so good that they invited me a few more times and they paid me actually. I was supposed to pay, you know, a whole lot of money and I ended up making some money. So that felt really good. That was actually my first bank account. I was able to open my first bank account with that money. But to the question, the US Embassy and a few people took notice of what I was doing. And so I got a recommendation letter to the embassy. I got interviewed and I told them, give me 2 weeks. I'll change the world. Just that's all I need. As soon as I go there, I'm going to run into Elon Musk and I'm going to be like, this is all the cool stuff I've done. And he's going to be like, yay, awesome. Yeah, obviously, we know that didn't happen. So, but that was the determination. The US Embassy thought what I was doing was pretty cool. And they said, yeah, you can go to the US and go figure stuff out and see where that goes. So.
Interesting. Actually, I'm very curious. What did you pitch that news station that made them want to come to you?
I told them that I am working on a propulsion system that's better than anything that's currently operational. Did I know this for certain at the time, like 100%? No, I did not. But did I have a hunch and did I have the boldness, audacity, whatever, to say that? Yes, absolutely. And I think the intention was not to be deceptive. Like, I wasn't sure that I could 100% defend my numbers, but I knew that I had put in all my heart and all my work and have done the work enough to appear on national TV. When I went on that TV show, I'm glad this didn't happen. I would have become a meme way before it might be a good thing. But my family was so not well-to-do that I couldn't afford to buy a belt to wear around my waist for my pants. And so my pants were loose fitting and it could have dropped while I was on national TV. And I was the only one who knew about that. It's just, when I look back, I laugh at it, but I told them that I had this amazing tech. And by the way, someone had to pay for me to go back home because I couldn't afford to go back because I spent all the money I had.
Yeah, it's crazy. I can't imagine how nerve-wracking that was.
Yeah, very.
Do you find it easy to explain your value prop to people? Because it's very hard to show people what you're doing. Like a software app, you're like, here's the app. Mm-hmm. Here's how many users we have. And I feel like there's so many misconceptions about space. So is it easy to explain to people your value prop?
It is very difficult. And also, even for people who are not novices, it comes in two flavors. For people who are novices to space and space exploration technologies and trying to pitch those people with the aim of raising money, it could be difficult because they have no idea what the heck you're talking about. And for people who are experts, you want to be able to keep your intellectual property safe and secure. And so you have to learn the art in both instances of being charismatic and being a good storyteller, maybe. Things that I hate doing, by the way. But you have to learn to be a good storyteller and color your words and get people who would otherwise not do it to invest in space. And with people who are experts in the field, you want to find a way to explain an idea without giving away the essence of the idea enough to keep them interested. And so I have, over the years, had to learn to do this. And that's how we've been able to float the company and raise money and not give away our IP and all of that stuff. So,
gotcha. I understand how you got to America. How did you found ARC and make it to LA?
When I moved to the US, my port of entry was Pittsburgh, and I was there for a little while, maybe almost a week. And then I thought to myself, Pittsburgh is really cold. It was summertime. I had just moved from the equator, and if I stay here until winter, I'm going to die. I also looked at some news articles, and I heard a lot of things were happening in California. To just give you a context, I had no idea what to expect. I didn't know what the US was. I mean, I kind of had a fair idea. People go to the US, all of that stuff. But there was nothing more than people build rockets and launch rockets in the US. That's it. And so I left Pittsburgh, heading to California, not knowing how far California was, not knowing what I was going to meet, who I was going to meet, whatever. And got to California. The first week I was in California, I dusted up my suit. I think I had a jacket and something. And I went to the SpaceX building and tried to walking, the security guard stopped me and said, you couldn't go any further than that. I stood outside, spoke to a bunch of the interns, and was able to get a bunch of numbers. Long story short, I spoke to Tom Maxukic, who was the vice president of propulsion, only after I'd been in the US for 2 weeks on the phone.
How did you get in touch with him?
I kept asking. I was resilient. I kept asking people and people who worked at SpaceX. I was like, I need Elon's number. I need to talk to him. And I finally was able to get the vice president of propulsion to talk to me only after about 2 weeks of my stay in the US. At the time, I still had some money and I stayed in a hostel. I founded ARK when I found out that in order to run a legitimate business operation in the United States, I needed to do that. And also I had to file for a bunch of patents, protect our intellectual property, and having a company to do that would show how serious I am about the things that I wanted to do. And I had no money when I started ARK, you know, and I literally had like $0. I had just fresh off the street. I was doing a website job. I was washing the dishes in a restaurant and going back home at around 12 or 1 a.m. after walking about 5 miles. So both ways would be, you know, about 10 miles there about every day. So I was doing this and going to aerospace conferences in Pasadena and doing all of that stuff. And eventually met a whole bunch of people in industry who advised me on the things to do and the things not to do. And that was what led up to ARK's formation and to filing for all the patents and doing all the stuff. So now we have a more organized operation. And I'm pretty proud and excited about what we've been able to do so far.
That's so amazing. Yeah, you were able to show your work and then people realize how legit you were. And then now you have your company. Cool. So actually, I'm very curious, what is your day-to-day like?
I do have a routine, you know, I love aerospace work. So I do a lot of engineering and I love music. So I actually do have time for listening to music. And I recently moved to a new neighborhood and I like to walk around. I love hiking. So every so often I would do that. And I love camping and every so often I would do that. And yeah, so just phone calls, business meetings, of which I have one and a very important business meeting today, minor detail, but yeah, that's basically what the daily routine of what would be running an aerospace company and serving as the chief technical officer and the chief executive officer would look like.
Yeah, so I imagine the engineering work, it was like what you were doing before you found the company, just research, making patents, making rockets. Oh, well, what are the business meetings usually about?
We are bringing in investment opportunities for the company. We're talking to some of the biggest VC firms in the country. They've been reaching out to us and asking for opportunities to partner. They want to know more about what we're doing. And so we are entertaining all of that stuff. And it's a pretty exciting stuff. Aerospace is all the buzz right now. There's a whole lot of money going in from private and from the government. And so these guys are looking to tap into that potential. And I'm really excited for that. I do not like business meetings as much as I love doing engineering. That's to be said, right? So I'm not super excited, but the company needs it. So I have to show up and I have to play my part.
What are the other space companies not doing that you guys are doing?
I think within the context of everything that can be done in space and with space, there's so much potential and so much versatility. And we basically found a niche. We basically found a place where most people have not paid a lot of attention to. And we found ways to do that better than they possibly could. And we filed for patent applications to allow for us to have a business advantage that we otherwise wouldn't have and to protect us as we negotiate with some of these big players. Space is expensive, right? And in order to succeed, we have to find innovative ways of bringing the cost down. SpaceX is mass, very rapid production, a low cost labor relative to Boeing and Northrop Grumman and some of these other companies. They found a way to make rockets cheap and they also recovering those rockets. And I give kudos to the engineers. I know a lot of the engineers that work at SpaceX. Those are 60s, 70s technology in the most literal sense of it. They just made some modifications, added software to it. What we are proposing is dial-up compared to high-speed gigabit internet, right? It's a world of difference in performance, not just the ability for us to fly a rocket and return it. We can operate at incredibly efficient levels that none of the current rockets, by their design, it's not magic, it's engineering, by the design of the current rockets, they couldn't operate at the same level. And we've been able to find those solutions. We've been able to patent those solutions. And we're really excited that we're getting the kind of attention from industry that we're getting now.
Yeah, I read ARC thinks you guys can improve the performance to cost ratio by a factor of 20. Is this just by optimizing all these factors together?
Yeah, you don't want to reinvent the wheel. One of the things that, you know, most ambitious aerospace programs run into is, you know, they want to redesign everything and rebuild everything. So we're going to be taking a whole lot of the technologies that are currently available in operational systems today. If I can improve performance by 1% or 2%, which in aerospace is a big deal, I might not want to invest as much money, or an investor might not see enough value to invest money there. It might be too risky. But if I'm offering a 40% improvement in performance, then that's a big thing. And so an investor might look into that. And we're doing this by focusing on critical systems, very few critical systems, not the entirety of the rocket. And we are confident that if we improve performance in those areas, the combination of the performance gains would lead to 20 times improvement in overall performance of our rocket system. And these are not just, you know, claims. We have raw data, computer simulations, and all of that stuff to prove that's very much within reason. So if we fall short by 10% or 20%, that is still a very huge performance increase compared to any of the systems that are operational. So we cannot go wrong with this. As long as we build our systems right, the result that we've gotten so far says that we are going to make a huge mark on the market. And I'm really excited for the future of humanity, frankly, not just for what I have achieved or I could achieve, but for what that means for the human race.
Yeah, what are your main short-term and long-term goals right now?
For ARC, the short-term goal would be to bring in all the money that we are currently talking to all of these guys about, and, you know, all the interest we've generated, trying to make sure we maximize that and do our job properly so that we are able to bring in all the value that we could. And in the long term, man has to become a space-faring species. We have to, not we want to because it's fancy or we can afford to. I think it's imperative that we have a colony, residents on the moon for mining purposes, but also for habitation purposes, because it'll teach us how to survive beyond our planet. In the case that something were to happen to our home planet, I don't believe in going to space so as to abandon Earth or this is our new home. It has always been our home. But I think diversifying and finding other ways to do things and learning about our world and about our universe is the most human thing about humans, more than almost anything else except maybe food and procreation and spirituality, obviously. But I think that's a very central part of our being, and we cannot neglect that. We cannot ignore that. And I think ARC will be a central part, a key part of making that happen. And that's where we're going with this.
Yeah. One thing I'm actually very curious about is how you set deadlines for ARC, because this is such uncharted territory. People can't give as good estimates on when things will complete. I have issues project managing my company. It's a software app. So I can only imagine the issues you run into.
Yeah, you bring in really smart people to help you with some of that. I am learning. I'm a very versatile person, I think, hopefully. And I continue to be as I learn, could be better. But I bring in really smart people to help with all the things that I couldn't do or to advise on all the things that I'm not skilled at. And so as far as managing our timelines and project planning and knowing what the next and most important thing to do might be, we do have some incredible minds that are working with us. I'm thinking back, you know, I think yesterday or the day before yesterday, I was thinking about some of the talent that we have. We have some top executives, you know, working from some of the biggest companies in the world on my staff and advisory board right now. And to think about the kid who had no idea what was going to happen to him the next day, I had to survive and live through religious riots and had to live through just insane hunger and incredible circumstances And not just me, a whole lot of kids who grew up in Africa have to deal with that. So I'm by no means a hero. And I don't say that to be humble. I don't think I am. It's just life and things happen. But to think that I've been able to get to a place where I have all these incredible people, I couldn't tell you how I feel about that. I'm incredibly blessed for that. So I'm grateful.
Yeah. And now several people have called you the next Elon Musk. How does that feel?
I actually have a bit of a resistance to that because I don't want to be the next Elon Musk. I don't think Elon Musk was the next whoever or anything else. They used to call me in Nigeria. They used to say he's going to be the next Bill Gates. I was like, well, who was Bill Gates? The next who? I think I understand the kindness and the thought that goes into that sentiment. But I think Elon Musk did not have to deal with some of the challenges that I had to deal with. He is not a person of color. He's a great achiever, incredibly smart man. But I want to be defined for me. I think the weight of my work and my personality would be able to carry it up. Grateful and excited to get to meet with Mr. Musk, but I don't want to be the next him. I want to be me.
I totally get that. What's your favorite and least favorite thing about your job right now?
Favorite thing about my job right now is the feeling of knowing that I know. This is the part of me, I don't know how people react to it, but you know, it's the weird rocket scientist, but knowing stuff that, the feeling that I know stuff that a whole lot of people do not know. It's that thing. It's like, I'm not the jock on the play field. Like, I'm not the cool guy. I'm not Chris Hemsworth, right? But I know stuff that these other people don't know. And there's a bit of insecurity in that. But that's my favorite part of my job, just being able to work on really cool stuff. And then the least favorite part would be sitting in on meetings, long meetings.
Yeah.
Don't like it one bit. And it's going to happen more and more so as we advance. There's going to be all this, you know, investor meetings and you're going to have to sit there for an hour. But yeah.
I can only imagine you're pitching constantly why you deserve to be funded.
Yeah.
Do you feel like quarantine has affected your career at all?
No. As a matter of fact, when it came around, weirdly enough, I did not freak out as much as I could have. I knew exactly how much I could have freaked out. I measured it in my head. I was like, oh my gosh, this is what the reaction to industry would be. And this is exactly what you should do, how you should feel about it. But one of the things you learn as a team leader, especially for a startup and a company as mine, you cannot show that to the people who have believed in you. You have to stay strong. You have to stay hopeful until the whole ship sinks and everything goes south. Then at that point, it's like, well, it's obvious. And so I think maybe that thought of having to stay strong and be the strong person helped me. And somehow they met somewhere in the middle where I just didn't feel anything about it and just let it go. And actually, we've made a whole lot of progress since the quarantine started than we had a few months before that. Like, things accelerated actually during this period of time. And that's the irony of it. There's a report that aerospace has actually not shrunk as most people thought it would. I mean, obviously, commercial aviation has been hard hit, but you know, aerospace within launch vehicles and military aviation and military systems have actually not shrunk by any, I don't think, significantly, or at least as much as they projected it would. So we are sitting pretty good. I'm pretty excited about times, and I hope things would return back to normal, economy would return back to normal. So
do you feel like there's a biggest mistake you made during your career?
Yeah, not trusting enough, because there were opportunities that I could have taken advantage of. I got to go to certain places and meet with certain people, but because I didn't think that I deserved to be there, I didn't take advantage of those opportunities. I didn't trust myself.
Imposter syndrome.
Yeah, I didn't take myself maybe seriously enough, or I wasn't kind enough to myself. And so I look back like, why didn't I say something? Or why didn't I, or whatever the case might be. But in the midst of that, I think I've also been rewarded. You know, I've got to meet some really impressive people and all of that stuff and continue to do that. So I do not think I have any regrets regarding that. But if I were to look back, not feeling confident enough to speak up in a room, which would have done a whole lot of good for me, would probably be my biggest regret, if you like. So
yeah. Well, on the other side, what do you think is the best thing you did for your career?
Just going for it, right?
Just
going for it. It's like, someone's got to do it, it might as well be me. That's the attitude, right? And per aspera ad astra, with great pain to the stars, I knew that it was going to be a difficult journey and I went for it. Whatever happens, whatever the outcome is, when I turn 70 or 80 and I'm talking to my kids or grandkids, I'll tell them that dad actually did this or grandpa actually did this. And so I am incredibly proud of myself for that. I'm humbled by it and I'm grateful to God and all the people that have helped me do that. I think that that would be the best decision that I have made, just going forward and not looking back.
Well, for others who are looking to get into aerospace, do you have any advice for them on how they could break in?
Yeah, just dream of the stars and watch a lot of Star Wars. No, I'm just kidding. Oh, you could do that. But that's fun. I'm more of a Star Trek fan than I am a Star Wars fan. I would say develop skills, problem-solving skills, and go for what most people might consider the most difficult problems and try to solve them from a very early stage. It trains your mind to deal with some of the things you're going to have to encounter. A good reason for that, this is important. There's something called a whack-a-mole problem in aerospace engineering, where as you try to whack one mole, another one pops out and you just keep whacking on different moles and then, you know, you never converge, you never get to a solution. And aerospace engineering is that way. You solve one problem, you create 50 others. You optimize the system to perform efficiently in one way, you ruin everything else on the other end. And there's really no way around it. It trains your mind. And the way I live my life in many ways is just a continuation of the thought processes that I brought in from, you know, aerospace engineering. Doesn't mean I'm boring, but it's a carry on from that. So my biggest advice would be go after difficult problems, try to solve them, be bold, be confident. Most aerospace engineers, up until after they graduate, have no idea what the heck they're doing. So you're not going to know what you're doing for a good portion of your career, but at least of your studies and time in school or whatever aspirational years, if that's the path you take, which obviously isn't the path that I took, but go after the difficult problems, try to solve them, have fun while doing that, and you'll make a brilliant engineer, I think.
Oh, I love that. Oh, thank you so much. So at the end of our show, we give guests 60 seconds to pitch anything they want. Is there anything you want to pitch?
Sure. I wasn't expecting that. Thank you. ARC is going to revolutionize space travel. It's going to revolutionize high-speed point-to-point civil aviation. And it's the revolution in hypersonics that we have been working towards over the past 40, 50 years. There's been a lot of development in aerospace engineering and aviation. And for the first time, we have gotten to a place where a whole lot of the things that we dreamt of as kids and we thought might be possible because of the improvement in material technologies and in our understanding of aerodynamic and propulsion technologies, that we are able to do all of those things. And so we have a unique combination in ARC, which is the ACE system, which is capable of operating as a launch vehicle, as a hypersonic system for many different applications. And we're going to be doing a lot of exciting things. Feel free to reach out to us on our website at airbreathing.space, breathing.space. You could fill out our form or you could email us directly at info@airbreathing.space. And yeah, I'm looking forward to going into the future and doing that exciting thing with everyone that we get to work with and interact with. I'm very excited for that.
Thank you guys so much for listening to our chat with Afnil Mabalo. He has so many awesome stories of persistence and dedication. And I just love how he sees every challenge as a problem to be solved. And by just persisting, he's really achieved his dreams. It's so awesome. You can find links to anything mentioned in the episode in our show notes at thenewschoolpodcast.com/episodes. Stick around to the end to hear a sneak peek of next week's episode. To stay up to date on content, make sure to follow us on Instagram at The New School Podcast and on Twitter at The New School Pod. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, you could find your review on a future The New School episode. Do you feel like you or someone else would be an amazing guest on our show? If yes, please contact us on our website, thenewschoolpodcast.com/contact. Want your ultimate guide on how to turn your passions into a meaningful career? Subscribe to our weekly newsletter at thenewschoolpodcast.com.
The New School with Christine Hong is produced by Jenny Snyder, Claire
Claire Whiteley and Alexia Mersola. Editing by Sydney Salk, John Simpson, and Joseph Cho. Special thanks to our marketing team who help us spread our mission and put the new school name out there. Katie Osaki, Dina Che, Marissa Wolfsheimer, and Giovanni Cortez. Next week, we're talking to the amazing Caroline Schoen, who works in an industry we're all familiar with yet don't know well, hotel management. Caroline discovered her passion for hotels at the age of 16 and went on to study at the top hospitality management program at Cornell, after which she became one of the youngest housekeeping managers at the Four Seasons. She's now the guest experience manager at Auberge Resorts in Big Island, Hawaii. Oh, and fun fact, her boyfriend is Joey Roth from season 1, episode 3.
If you let people be the color in the room and you give these compelling characters the space to let their colors come to life and really understand what excites them, what their personalities are, why are they traveling, what do their kids like, all these little details, you'll be able to create this experience and this day that is going to completely blow them out of the water. And that is what excites me.
Come back next Monday to find out from Caroline how she broke into hotel management, what working in different luxury resort locations across the world is like, and what her current day-to-day is like. All right, guys, have a great day. Try something new today.